County came out and passed the result before most of the friends got here. First thing, this is the schedule of the day that the facility will be closed. So November 25th to the 26th, December 23rd to the 25th, December 30th, January 1st. I'll put that right up here and friends will make a note of all that. I think we have a problem with that. So today's lesson is going to be on the five messages in the book of Haggai. And we'll see how they apply to Israel at the time. And the scripture lessons probably geared more for the church at this time of the age. In return to the book of Haggai, it begins in the second year of Darius. 3 Haggai 1:1, where it is written, in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Zerubbabel, the high priest, saying, so, just to get us in the time frame of where we're at in the stream of time, what we need to do is go back to the book of Ezra. This is where Haggai is actually giving the messages we're about to examine in the book by his name. And the book of Ezra is like the book of Acts. To get in Acts, and when we read through the epistles of Paul, to get an idea of the environment of the various cities, like Ephesus, Corinth, Galatia, we really have to go back to the book of Acts to get the details. Well, when we read through Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, we have to go to Ezra and Nehemiah to get those details of what kind of environment it was. And why the messages were so unethical. So, we turn to Ezra 1:1, and the friends are going to be familiar with most of this, but each time I go through Ezra and Nehemiah, I'm always impressed with something else that I didn't quite see to help fit the bigger picture together. So, we're going to take an overview of Ezra, and hopefully the friends will find it profitable. Ezra 1:1 through Ezra 4. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and hath charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people, his God, be with him? And let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is the God, which is in Jerusalem. And whosoever remaineth in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver and with gold and with goods and with beasts, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And then verse 7. Also Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem, and had put them in the house of his gods. So, we're familiar, you know, this is the year 536 when Cyrus made this proclamation that the Jews now were free to return to their homeland and rebuild their temple. And, of course, the spiritual picture is, the pastor has comments, Cyrus means son, or son of righteousness, which really is fitting. that Cyrus being the one who opened up the way for the Lord's people to have the freedom to build the temple. Now, when you look in the Gruden's concordance of names, it means heir or miserable. And heir, we see how fitting that is, of course, that Jesus was the heir of all things, as Isaac was from Abraham. But miserable also has the implication that he was a man of sorrow. So it all seems fitting to point that Cyrus being a type of Jesus. And of course, building the temple, that's what Jesus began. He opened up the new living way for which the church would be the living stones of that temple. And then in verse 7, where Cyrus brings out all the vessels of the temple, things old, things new, to this Jesus that he really brought the Word of God to a way that we could understand it and use it. So, here we are, 536, this proclamation is made. When we go to Ezra chapter 2, it gives all the names and the numbers of the people that returned with Zerubbabel, who would be governor over them. So here, it's recorded that not everybody went back, of course. Only a remnant actually went back. Most of them were pretty comfortable in Babylon. And many of them, as we read in Esther, they were all over. They were all over the countryside. So only this remnant went out, just as the Lord's day when he opened up that new living way, only a handful of people followed him. Chapter 3, the building of the altar. And Ezra 3:2, we see, then stood up Joshua, the son of Josedek, and his brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and built the altar of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So, the first thing, the altar is the first thing I can focus on. Here's, they've got this freedom, this remnant returns. The first thing they want to do is worship God properly. And it's through the offering of sacrifice. This is for ourselves. Ezra 3, 8, 9, and 10. So we see as soon as they finish building, reasonable living conditions for themselves. They promptly went to work on starting the altar, which really showed they had the right spirit and zealousness for the Lord. So they really understood their purpose for returning back and showing the gratitude towards those lines. Ezra 3:8, now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Josedek, and the remnant of their brethren, the priests, and the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. 9. Then stood Joshua with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel and the sons of Judah together, and set forward the workmen in the house of God, the sons of Henadad with their sons and their brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the son of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord, and the ordinance, after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And we remember King David was the one that set up all the singers. We remember Asaph and He-Man and all those that were really talented at what they did. Well, the spiritual lesson from 3 is that of this temple is that it represents a church in which Jesus is the chief cornerstone. Jesus laid the foundation of the spiritual temple at Calvary in Revelation 21:14. We are told of 12 additional foundations to this temple having the apostles' names on them. There is the additional picture that this is the rebuilding of the spiritual temple by those who left Babylon the Great during the Reformation of the 16th century. So there's a couple of pictures there that can apply to that. And this is coming up in verses 3-13, 3:11-3:13. And they sang together by chorus, in praising and giving thanks unto the Lord, because he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. The word is heard. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and chiefs of the fathers, who were ancient men and had seen the first house when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy. So that the people could not discern the noise from the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. The old man remembered the glory of Solomon's temple before it was destroyed some 70 years prior. And they wept at the sight of the more humble and simple foundation before them, while others filled with joy at the sight of a new beginning and hope. And of course, the friends are familiar with that. And Haggai's messages, we'll see, are brought back to this point. When we get to chapter 4, where the work is hindered and finally stopped. Ezra 4, 1-5. Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity built the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, let us build for you, for we seek your gods, as ye do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, which brought us up hither. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the chiefs of the fathers of Israel said unto him, ye have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even unto the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now when the copy, and then verse 23, now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai, the scribes, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews and made them to cease by force and power. So, let me not get ahead of myself here. Ezra 4:24. Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, for it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius king of Persia. Okay, so it sounds like the neighbors are trying to be friendly participants, but let's see why their offer was so unacceptable. We have to set the Wayback Machine for the year 739. And that takes us back to 2 Kings 17:6. Here they're coming out and they're saying, hey, you know, you guys are really zealous for God and you're building a temple. Let us help you. And, you know, we'll really help expedite things and we want to worship God too. And here's the governor and the high priest and the chiefs are just saying, thanks or no thanks. You have nothing to do. 2 Kings 17:6-8. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria, and carried Israel away into Assyria, and placed them in Helah and in Habor by the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, which had brought them up out of the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods, and walked in the statutes of the heathen whom the Lord had out from before the children of Israel, and the kings of Israel, which they had made. They're being punished. So we know they're going to captivity. We drop down to 1724. And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, and from Cutta, and from Ava, and from Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them, because they know not the manner of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry thither one of the priests whom ye brought from thence, and let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land. Then one of the priests who had taken away from Samaria came and dwelt in Israel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit, every nation made gods of their own, and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt. And the men of Babylon became Succoth-Benoth, and the men of Cuth made Nergal. So you get this nice word of heathen gods, which is kind of an interesting study in itself. Hamath made Ashima, and Avites, Nibhaz, and Tarpak, and Sepharites burnt their children in the fire to Adramelech and Anamelech, and the gods of Sepharvaim. 32, and they feared the Lord, and made unto themselves the lowest of them priests of the high places which sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord, and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from them. Unto this day they do after the former manners. They fear not the Lord, neither do they fear their statutes, or after their ordinances, or after the law and commandments which the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. So here they got this hodgepodge blend of, just like Israel was worshiping pagan gods, well, the new batch of replacement people, even though they had a priest come in, they went their own way. They grabbed some of what the priest was teaching them, but they kept a lot of their old idolatry as well. So it was really quite a mess. And I think this is why Jesus told the Samaritan woman in John 4:22, when he was talking to her, remember they were at the well, and he said, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. So she recognized, and he recognized that. And the Jewish people, that God was revealing to them, and that the way had been open for them. But just the way he said that, I always thought that was rather interesting. You worship, you know not what. ultimately, he did bring them over. So the Samaritans were pretty put out by the Jews being so exclusive and apparently full of great zeal and focus to raise them up for the worship of their God. This oneness of purpose probably made the neighbors quite nervous and wanted to discourage the Jews before they established themselves as a nation. Their lawyers managed to tie up the construction of the temple for the better part of 15 years. The rest of Cyrus's reign, all of Cyrus's son Cambyses' reign, Smyrna's the Magi's short reign, all the way to the second year of Darius, also known as Hystaspes. So, if you remember the construction of 696, they did the east side and got that all done, and then I-75 was held up for the better part of 20 years because of lawyers and the community and Oak Park and same sort of deal. Construction's all ready to go and it's just come to a complete standstill. Well, that 15 years brings us to the year 521 BC. Foundation is laid, weeds are probably now growing over it, and of course, the people, the land, they have to keep going, so they're building their houses, they're getting the city, you know, built up, and that brings us to Ezra 5:1. Then the prophet Haggai, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Zadok, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and with them were the prophets of God helping them. What did Haggai say that motivated Zerubbabel? Now we turn to Haggai. So the book of Haggai has only two chapters. It contains five messages, all of which are given in the second year of Darius, between the sixth month and the ninth month of the year 521. As we read in Ezra, Haggai and Zechariah were the prophets of the time. Haggai, much older than Zechariah, who was Haggai's successor. So the first three verses tell us when and why. Haggai 1:3. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Jeshua, the son of Joshadak, the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, This people say, The time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Okay, so they're still stalling. Still tied up in court. Our hands are tied. We can't do anything. This is message number one. Haggai 4-11. It is time for you, O ye, to dwell home. Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in ceilinged houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Ye have sown much, and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it in a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it. And I will be glorified, saith the Lord. Ye looked for much, and lo, it came too little. And when ye brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith the Lord of hosts, because of my house that is waste, and ye run every man unto your own house. Therefore, the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. And I called for a drought upon the land, and upon the mountains, and upon the corn, and upon the new wine, and upon the oil, and upon that which the ground bringeth forth, and upon men, and upon cattle, and upon all the labor of the hands. So the Lord is telling them, you all have cozy little homes, but all I have is a 15-year-old foundation sitting out there. I have been withholding my blessings from you. I've been withholding my blessings from you and your labor, hoping the chastisement would turn your attention to the temple. But it hasn't gotten anything done. Now, if you get the materials together and build my house, I would be pleased. Evidently, the first message was received loud and clear. Haggai 1:12. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Zadok, high priest. priest with all the remnant of the people obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet as the Lord their God had sent him. And the people did fear before the Lord. Well, the message is the same for us. Not to be so involved in our daily routines and concerns that we become slack towards the Lord and His temple, which we are. So, in spite of the work stop, the neighbor, and all of that, he's saying, what are you doing? You know, it's just, you've got to be putting your faith into action. And so, the message number two comes along. The Lord saying that the construction resumed in spite of the work stop order still in effect, showing they feared the Lord more than the government, sent the second message of encouragement 3 weeks later. This Haggai 13, 14, and 15. Then spoke Haggai the Lord's messenger unto the Lord, in the Lord's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith the Lord God. And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shephiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Joshadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and did work in the house of the Lord of hosts their God. In the 420th day of the 6th month, in the 2nd year of Darius the king. 1 month later, the Lord sends the third message through Haggai again to encourage him to be strong and have faith. Not to be disheartened because the foundation walls fall way short of the original story, but because God appreciates what little we are able to give, and He has everything to make it glorious according to His will. Again, He reminds them, I am with you. So in spite of all this adversity and legal tie-up, He's encouraging them, you're doing the right thing, and I am with you. You're pleasing me now. He sends this message along, and He sends it to us. Hang in there, have faith, be strong. And the way Haggai puts it, in the 7th month, is the 2nd chapter, 2:1. This is the third message. In the 7th month, in the 120th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Joshadak, the high priest, and to the rest of the people, saying, who is left among you that saw this house in your first glory? And how do you see it now? It is not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing. So here, we're going right back to where we saw in Ezra, those that were weeping and those that were shouting with joy. So even the Lord recognizes this is pretty humble compared to Solomon. And yet now, be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Joshadak, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when ye came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you. Fear ye not. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens, and the earth, and the sea, and the dry land. And I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. So, of course, we recognize the end of this, more prophetic towards the end. But the message is to be strong, to have faith, that no matter how little you think you're offering to the Lord, seems like you just can't hardly get anything done. Your offering, your labor towards the Lord is small and insignificant. He's telling all of us, as he's telling Zerubbabel and all the people, I can make it glorious. I'm the one that's going to fill this with glory. So don't worry about that. You're being very teasing with me because I appreciate the effort you're putting into it. I appreciate your zealousness. I appreciate your obedience. Don't worry about the neighbors. Don't worry about the government. Don't worry about any of that stuff. Just keep focused on me because I'm with you. I'm with you in all of it. So it's very encouraging. The prophetic aspect of these verses, though applicable even then, have even greater significance at the end of the age. Verses 6 through 9 are basically interpreted in Hebrews 12. And we'll just take a quick look at that. Hebrews 12, 25 through 29. The Apostle Paul speaking. Hebrews 12, 25 through 29. See that ye refuse not him that speaketh. For if they escape not who refused him that spake on earth, much more shall not ye escape. If we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he has promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. He once shook the earth, of course, at Mount Sinai, when he gave the commandments. But now he's going to not only shake the earth, but heaven also. The spiritual powers well entrenched in the world. And this word, yet once more, signifies the removing of those things that are shaken as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, we receive a kingdom which cannot be moved. Let us have grace thereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. So, very similarly, the temple, the only way the temple can be destroyed is if God destroys it or allows it to be destroyed. Everything else, empires, nations, religious structures of the earth, they're all going to be shaken. And if they're not approved of God, they'll be coming down. So we return to Haggai 2:8. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. Well, silver, typically the symbol for truth, and the gold, divine character. So the Lord is rich and has everything that will bring glory to his temple. So the Lord is making this point. I have the power. I've got the finances. I'm rich with everything that it takes to make this little foundation and this temple that you're building on is glorious. Because all the silver, all the gold is mine. So, before Haggai is given a fourth message, the Lord speaks to the prophet Zechariah, which we read in Zechariah 1:1. Now, we left off. He starts out in the sixth month. He gives a message in the seventh month. Gives another message in the seventh month. So now, Zechariah 1:1, in the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, the Lord hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord. But ye, act as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Turn ye now from your evil ways and from your evil doings. But they did not hear, nor hearken unto me, saith the Lord. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? But my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, Like as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. So Zechariah gives this message first, and then Haggai follows it up. But it's a message of warning. It's a message of don't forget, it was your fathers that created this whole mess that got you into Babylon because they wasn't listening to me. But the real thrust here is turn unto me and I will turn unto you. So again, it's a promise that keep your focus on the Lord. Don't get distracted. Don't get carried away with the idols of the world and all the things of that can distract us and so be sympathetic. Don't get discouraged. As long as you turn to Him, to the Father, He'll turn to you. So don't forget the history. We've got the whole history of the world of mankind to reflect on the results of those that don't follow the Lord compared to those that do follow the Lord. And so that's a reminder that should be forever implanted in the forefront of our minds whenever we do our inventory to see where we're at and make sure we're not getting too distracted by whatever it may be. So Haggai's message is very similar. 2 months later, after his last message, and a month after Zechariah just gave his message, Haggai gives his fourth one, and that's Haggai 2:10. You know, I'm just burning to get this gist for us, so I hope you all enjoy another one. In the 24th day of the 9th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Ask now the priest concerning the law, saying, If one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread, or pottage, or wine, or oil, or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, No. Then said Haggai, If one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, It shall be unclean. Then answered Haggai and said, So is this people, and so is this nation before me, saith the Lord, and so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean. And now I pray you, consider, or remember, from this day and upward, from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Lord, since those days were, when one came to a heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to a wine vat for a draw out 50 vessels out of the press, there were but 20. I smote you with blasting and with mildew and with hail and all the labors of your hands, yet ye turn not to me, saith the Lord. Consider now from this day and upward, from the 24th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of the temple was laid, consider it, or remember it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yes. As yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree have not brought forth, from this day will I bless you. So the message that they are not to forget that they were unclean, not having a temple in which to seek atonement for their sins. Their labor did not prosper, but now the Lord assures them that He will bless them. Of course, we are not to forget that we were once children of wrath, of disobedience, until we gave our lives to the Lord and became stone, being shaped for the glorious temple, nearly complete now. And then without delay, Haggai gives his fifth message. And the Lord spake his word to Haggai a second time on the 24th day of the month. He said, Say to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, I am going to shake the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms and destroy the power of nations. I will overthrow chariots and their riders, and the horses will fall along their riders. They will kill one another with swords. On that day, declares the Lord of armies, I will take you, my servant Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord. I will make you a signet ring because I have chosen you, declares the Lord of armies. So these points, this message points to the trouble at the end of the age. Of course, the Lord did perform these in a smaller way for the people of Israel, but the Lord of armies would be the Lord's great army. But the promise is that the Lord will take Zerubbabel, whose name means a stranger of Babylon, as we are strangers and pilgrims in this world. The Lord's promise is, and of course the signet ring was used to identify the beholder as one who had been given full of power and authority. This would apply to the Christ worthy to escape the trouble and overthrow described in verse 22. I will overthrow the thrones and kingdoms and destroy the power of nations. I will overthrow the chariots and the riders. So, we know the chariots are platforms. Chariots are drawn by horses. Chariots are the platform that gives those doctrines a place to be taught. And their riders, of course, those that are given forth those doctrines and stand upon those platforms, all that's going to be taken away. And those doctrines will be exposed and they'll fall with their riders. So we see we have the symbology, of course, and they will kill one another with their swords. So there's five simple messages. What are you waiting for? That's message number one. What are you waiting for? Let's go. Message number two, the Lord will be with us. Message number three, have faith and be strong. Don't compare the temple as you see yourself with others. The Lord can make any little thing shine with glory. Message number four, don't forget. Remember what the Lord has done and be grateful. And then message number five, if faithful, we will be hid in the day of trouble, and glory and honor shall be ours. So that's the discourse on Haggai's five messages. I wasn't sure how long it would take to get through all those scriptures, but may the Lord overrule anything said in this. And I know this subject is, y'all may have thoughts or comments or notes on any of that. And it would be just time to bring those out. If the friends would like to have a question or a comment or something they'd like to add, I'm sure you can go as deep as you'd like on this. We try to bring out the things that the friends are familiar with. I didn't find anything to elaborate on or expound on that would be bringing out anything more than these simple words of encouragement.
have kind of I really love to talk. I was just puzzled, but of course I'm generally puzzled by some of these really significant prophecies we find, like discourse. But anyway, in Haggai 2, there, we're talking about don't be discouraged when you see, when you compare the temple with the old temple. This temple will be much greater. How do you think you might have said this in a minute, but how do you think they would think, what do you think they would be thinking of things in 6 and 7 there? Because we would take it and apply it to them. You know, they'll shape all nations and all this. But why do you think he meant for them to understand when he said that in this context? Did you already cover that and missed it? I mean, I'm sure, like, that must, like, there's all these levels of meaning, but, like, when they're listening to him about don't be discouraged about the comparing this temple with the other temple, be strong, don't let yourself, you know, stop working on it. How would this be an encouragement to them at that time?
Well, I think just the way I view that is the Lord is giving a message that I'm still dealing with you. And we brought you back. Don't worry about this temple. I mean, they tore down Solomon's temple and they burned it and they beat it up. So the foundation that they built a new one out of were basically using the stones from the past. They had to resize them to get them to work right, so you end up smaller. Of course, they didn't have the manpower and the riches that Solomon had to pour it all in there. So when you get to 6 and 7, it says, and the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, and that will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea. I think it just restored their hope that, yeah, we are still the blessed nation. We're the blessed seed, and if the Lord is happy with this temple, then we just want to get it built, and we want it to be as good as we possibly can do it. And the Lord is going to bless us as a nation for that. And our enemies, they're the ones that are going to go down. So I think it just took courage in that and encouragement that the Lord wouldn't be giving them this message if, you know, because he follows it up with, don't forget the past, you know, stay on the track you're on. Don't forget what your fathers did. They blew it. They had the big temple. They had the glory. They had the blessing. They had everything, and they threw it away. Don't you do that. No matter how small you might think this temple is, or your place in the land, you don't have the government that you once had. It's been taken away. The Persians are now over you. Babylon was over you. Don't let that bother you. Babylon's still over you. And we're gonna make this work up. Because all those governments, those Gentile nations over you, I'm going to shake them down. But this little temple, it's going to be full of glory. Well, I don't know if that helps. Anyone else have a... Does that help at all? Any other comments on that particular part of it? For Richmond?
I was also likewise thinking that in that chapter 2, verse 7, and chapter 2, verse 22, in both of them, it's talking about what has to be a, could have only had a limited fulfillment back then, because in 2, 7, it says all nations, and in 22, it's overthrow the kingdoms and destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen. And obviously that all hasn't been accomplished yet, you know, bringing out. So it just tells us that we should look for the antitypical significance that you were telling us, because these verses require definitely a further fulfillment to really come to pass. They might have a limited application back there. So just along with what you were saying, you might have said this too, in verse 8, I was just thinking, you know, the silver represents usually the great company, and the gold, the little flock, the divine nature and the spirit nature. And it almost seemed that when the Lord says, the silver is mine and the gold is mine, it's like saying, I've got my spirit company complete, little flock, great company. So because of that, they're all mine, they're all chosen. Now I can move forward with the next phase and shake down to complete destruction with anarchy the rest of these nations, so that the desire of those nations can really come in the kingdom of peace through my gold and through my silver, through the little flock and the great companies in a peaceable kingdom. But until they're all his, then it's got to wait. So that just kind of seemed like it blended itself with that.
That's good. I didn't really focus on the great company. It crossed my mind, but I wasn't sure if I should bring that up or not. But, you know, the comments like from the past for the divine silver being representing truth, like the sockets of the tabernacle. But yeah, the spirit begotten by the great company, little flock, and being dealt with, and then the shaking, the great shaking. Okay, thank you. Further comments on any part of Haggai or Zechariah or Ezra that we covered? Remember that the whole temple, it would be another, this is the second year of Darius, it's not. And I'm probably not going to reflect it, but bring it out back in Ezra. It's in chapter 6, verse 14 and 15. And the elders of the Jews built it, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Edo. And they built it and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel and according to the commandment of Cyrus and of Darius and of the 13th. And this house was finished on the third day of the month, Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. So that completes the temple in 517. Which took a full 20 years to actually get the temple built. And then when we get to chapter 7, it's 50 years after that, Ezra comes in, and he's the one that sets up the priesthood and says, okay, now let's get everybody doing what they're supposed to do here and get our religious, get us together in our religious order and fulfilling our role as priests and Levites and really organizing the people and setting up the synagogue. Brother Rick?
Well, on that, I had a note, I wouldn't have remembered this offhand, a note that I made that in that Ezra 6, verse 14, at the end of it, it says, according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and in 15, and this house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which is in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. The peculiarity is Artaxerxes reigned after this Darius was finished. And so you say to yourself, well, the temple was really completed before Artaxerxes ever came to the throne. Because this is our Artaxerxes, which in the seventh year, we read that he allowed Ezra to go back. And in his 20th year, we read in Nehemiah, that's when Nehemiah went back. The temple was already done. So, the suggested harmony is that Cyrus gave the decree at the beginning to go back and build it. Darius, with other kings in between Cyrus and Darius, it was in Darius's year that it was completed under Darius's direction. But Artaxerxes gets mentioned because he sent Ezra back to restore the temple worship properly. So he gets credited in with the building, but not the building of the building, rather in the rebuilding of the services, because what good is the temple if your services aren't acceptable? So he seems to get honorable mention in here, especially in the book of Ezra, because he sent Ezra back that would allow him to do this. So Ezra would like to get his name mentioned in here as contributing to this. And I think so that's one of the little things that at first it throws you out on.
Yes, that's good. The comments just say that even though Artaxerxes came much later, but it didn't really go into it. But yeah, that makes good sense. That the temple, if it represents us, that it's not just the heart, it's not the brick and mortar, but really getting that spiritual guidance and the real focus of doing our priestly job. Yes, that would be part of the temple. The temple has no meaning without that. Okay, thank you.
I think when we do the math with our kings, I think it's like 48 years after the temple was completed.
Yeah, I think the passage rounds it off to 50 years, but there's definitely a gap of time there before Ezra comes in, and there's another 20 years after him before Nehemiah goes in and shears up the walls. So it shows the Lord works in stages. He's not impatient. Not everything gets done at the same time. Just like the temple, you get it established, you get everything functioning, you get start getting all your ducks in a row, as it were, so that now your way of life fits your life, and then we maintain that, and we keep that in good working order, and then we can build upon that. So it's always nothing's in a big rush. You know, we're slow. We have to get slow.
I'm sorry, I missed up on it, but did you mention the BC dates for the building of the temple? I didn't catch it, I'm sorry.
Well, 536, they went back and laid the foundation. 15 years later, which brings you to 521, Haggai tells them to the Lord, come on, let's get going on this thing. You know, 50 years, nothing's happening. And so 521, they're re-inspired to go back to work, come what may. And another 4 years, they finally get the building completed. So that's going to be 517, 516. You'll see those dates both come up. Probably the fall of 517, which would be 516, the first 4 year that the temple was complete. And then 48 to 50 years later, which would be 466 BC, the emperor returns to establish the priesthood. I don't have it there. I don't have it down to read mine perfectly.
That's true.
And then, like, 50 years later, Ezra returns and doesn't. And then, Nehemiah, like, shortly thereafter, and Nehemiah is involved with the wall. How much longer after that? I can't ever get that straight. How much longer after Ezra is Nehemiah?
I thought Nehemiah was, like, closer to 20 years later, but I'm not sure.
Ezra was what, the 7th year of Artaxerxes? Nehemiah was the 20th year of Artaxerxes?
Yeah, the 20th year of Artaxerxes
What did you say in the beginning about comparing the book of Acts with the book of Ezra? What was your comment there?
Well, many of the minor prophets, after when you read Hosea and Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, you refer to the book of Kings and Chronicles. Daniel, of course, is during the Babylonian captivity, and then Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi are post-Babylonian, so you have to refer to when they came out of Babylon. So you have to look back at Ezra, who tells us about Zerubbabel, who was the first to come out, because he was probably going through the records of the priests and stuff, and he puts it all together for us as to what went down before his day that brought it up to the point of his return. So we have to go see what was going on, what delayed the temple. Because Haggai doesn't give you any of that information. He just says, hey, let's get this temple built. Well, what seems to be the problem? You go to Ezra, and it's like, oh, well, the neighbors are all giving them a hard time. And now it's all tied up in the cords of the land, and even Cyrus, he was probably confronted with having to deal with this little bit on the legal matter from all these Protestants, but that would be very close to the end of his reign. He died probably shortly after he made the proclamation, and then Cambyses came in, and he was the one like, okay, now what did Dad do? What's going on here? Well, I'll just stop everything, God, figure it out. But like Acts, if you want to know the apostle,
what happened to
Apostle Paul, what is his relationship with the Corinthians? What is his relationship with Ephesians? We go back to Acts and we look at the history and the details, and it's like, oh, okay. Ephesians ran him out of town. They wanted to kill him. You know, there was a super riot going on. So here, this handful of faithful ones that he praises in the book of Ephesians, well, these are really living in an environment of great opposition. Mary, you know, Diana was the queen of their world. So just to give you some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sister Betty, do you have another thought? Sister
Debbie.
Yeah. I don't know if it's, you know, just tell me that now if it's not suitable, you know, but Patali's family, how does that fit in? Is it, you know, with the years that they were working in Jerusalem for Cyrus, I mean, if you can, Cyrus through what, is it Darius II? Or is it just Artaxerxes? Because he goes Cyrus, Amos, Darius the First, Xerxes, Artaxerxes the First, Darius the Second, then Artaxerxes the Second, and so forth. How do you work out how that fits in Ezra and Nehemiah?
Actually, I visited my, just on myself, I just looked at the list of the kings involved in all of this, of Persia. I just wanted on Esther, and basically everything I looked at as far as the kings of Persia and their reign, you get kind of a hodgepodge of information if you try to go to like Strong's or anything, and Tally has his list. You go online, you get a different list, and Brother Rickers has studied this in the past, so we referred to his notes on that too. That would be, I can't even elaborate on that at all. But I think that's just, Brother Rick probably has more information about that. But if you would want to comment or offer on that, would be the go-to person, the kings of Persia. I have just about hardly any confidence in because to figure it out. Especially when you're reading, you know, they all have these titles, and the way the scriptures use them, he doesn't want you to follow the kings of, the only thing we have really for sure are the kings of Judah, and that we can really hang our hat on, the kings of Persia, Babylonian kings, there's just not enough there to give anybody like a great bit of confidence, but I'm starting to get more and more of a picture of who was probably in charge and how long they reigned. But you know, the discourse on Esther was really a head scratcher for me. I spent more time trying to figure that out before I realized, man, I'm not getting anything done on my discourse. I'm just going to go with homework already done by others and try to pick up the story. Brother Rick?
Should I throw some things out on that?
Sure.
That came up. What you're saying is all absolutely correct. And I don't have my Persian king list in front of me, but I do have a few notes that we put in Ezra for ourselves. You have in Ezra 1:1, much what you said, I'm just repeating. Ezra 1:1, it tells us the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that they were told to go back. That's the year in Ptolemy's canon that we're interested in. Cyrus's first year. So what Ptolemy's canon gives us, just like a canon tells you, it gives you periods of reign, the number of years that a king reigned. Ptolemy's canon does not give you a date for each king. So it tells you the kings of Babylon, how long each one reigned, the kings of Media Persia, how long each one reigned, and the kings of Greece, how long each one reigned, and we jump in. Ptolemy's canon, I like to jump in with Alexander the Great and his father, the king of Macedonia, because they're very much more easily confirmed and no one's questions their years, because they went by the Greek Olympians, and we could count every 4 years back from our time to get to them. So that's real easy. Then we just count on Ptolemy's canon backwards, the periods of the reign of years for the rest of the Greek kings through the Persians, and we get back to the first Persian king on the list, which was Cyrus, and then we plug in the date from Alexander the Great, all these periods of years, to Cyrus' first year, and it gets us 537 in the fall, or 536 the fourth year. Just now, in the book of Ezra, like you said, Brother Chris, if we turn to the fourth chapter, verse 6. In fact, I'm going to start in verse 5. There was a three readings, if you're at 4 or 5. The enemies of Judah and the land, they hired basically lawyers, or you might say, who is it that referred to the congressmen to make their appeal, what we call them, it's a profession, but we don't think of it.
Lobbyists,
thank you. They hired their lobbyists to go up to their king. And it says, it frustrated the Jews' purpose all the days of Cyrus, we've already covered him, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now, between Cyrus and Darius, you've got a number of these Persian kings. In 6, it says, in the reign of Ahasuerus, and Ahasuerus is that's a title like Pharaoh or Caesar. So we peg in there the name, and you said it, Cambyses. This Ahasuerus here is not the Ahasuerus of Esther, like you said. This is Cambyses. In verse 7, and in the days of Artaxerxes, wrote these different individuals. This Artaxerxes, again, Artaxerxes is a title, like Pharaoh or Caesar. This is actually Smyrnus. S-E-S-M-E-R-D-I-S, I think, Smyrnus. This Smyrnus is called an imposter king. He really wasn't of the royal lineage, but through finagling, he got himself in.
Smyrnus the Magi.
Yes.
7 months.
Yes. And he was an enemy of Israel. In verse 23, this Artaxerxes still is a Smyrnus. So, during Cambyses' reign and during the Smyrnus' reign, the temple was thwarted. Then, where we were in Ezra 6 and verses 14 and 15, where we just all had read earlier, it just tells us that the house finally got built, the temple finally got built under the commandment of Cyrus, he was the first one, and Darius, he was the one in whose reign it was finally completed, because he gave this commandment to go back, to rebuild it. And this Darius, you said it was the first one. That's Darius Hystaspes. And then this Artaxerxes is given honorable mention here. This is not the Artaxerxes we read about earlier in the book, because that was an opponent to the temple. This Artaxerxes is included as being given a commandment in relationship to the temple. Like we had mentioned earlier, it's really odd, because this Artaxerxes hadn't reigned yet. Yet Ezra gives him honorable mention. And we'll elaborate a little bit more. It says in verse 6:17, that they offered at the dedication of the house of God 100 bullocks and so on. So it tells us that the temple was dedicated. Now you turn to the 7th chapter, and in verse 1 it says, now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Seraiah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah, and so on. Verse 6, after we get his whole long lineage all the way back to Aaron. This Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given, and the king granted him all his requests according to the hand of the Lord upon him. Then went up some of the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, singers, porters, Nethinims, to Jerusalem, and here we are, the 7th year of Artaxerxes the king. This is why Artaxerxes, and this Artaxerxes is known as Longimanus. Artaxerxes Longimanus. This Artaxerxes is mentioned as giving a commandment for the building of the temple, even though he gives his commandments regarding the temple after it had already been built, as was said earlier, 48, 49, 50 years earlier. However, he he sent Ezra back to get the services going. So he gets honorable mention by Ezra. So in my mind, that gives us, when Ezra returned, and this Artaxerxes, son of Gia, who was favorable to the temple, that was Line of Madness, but it was fabulous after the temple had been built. And then again, just lastly, in Nehemiah, the next book, Nehemiah, chapter 1, verse 1, it tells us that the words of Nehemiah came to pass in the 20th year when he was at Shushan the palace. Now Shushan is the Persian capital. And we jump all the way down to the second chapter, verse 1. In the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the king was before him, and then Nehemiah makes his plea. So that we have the same, this is our Artaxerxes Law of Emmaus. And in the 7th year, Ezra went up. And now in his 20th year, Nehemiah goes up. And as you brought out, Nehemiah went back up to build the walls of the city. Because the temple was all done. And Ezra had gone back to start the temple services properly, get the priests back on track. And now the city needed to be completed. So Nehemiah went back, and then they were like a tag team together. Ezra the priest, Nehemiah the statesman and like leader, and together with the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, they all worked to get Israel back on track and in order. But so anyway, that's kind of fun.
Thank you. So the part that, just to put things in a little bit of perspective as well, the 536, the Zerubbabel and a handful of faithful followers go back, and they're zealous for the Lord. They go back and they go immediately build the altar. Having done that, they throw up some living places, but they really focus on the altar, and then they go right to work on the foundation of the temple. It's 70 years later, Ezra comes from Babylon to get the temple services in order and establish. So Jews are still comfortably living in Babylon. They're all settled in. And 13 years later, Nehemiah comes from Babylon. So just to show that the Jews, and then we established in Esther as well, the decree that went out, probably it might have even been the same king trying to figure out. He kept mixing his signals as to the Jews are in favor, the Jews aren't in favor. they're scattered all over the place. And so next thing you know, that's why we see, there's Jews throughout the entire world, even to this day, just all settled in. And a repeat of history when Jerusalem was opened up again, and after World War I, the Balfour Declaration, etc., only a handful of zealous ones moved right back in and took advantage of that, but the rest of the Jews are pretty cozy where they're at. And even though the Lord's trying to stir them up to anti-Semitism, etc., to really get back to their roots and really focus on Him. Point, not to embrace the law, but to embrace Him. And so we see, the Lord keeps teaching the same lessons. He gives you a type, and then He gives you an antitype, and it's for the same result. Lead everybody back to Him ultimately. So I think, this is a history that's great to review. The history is interesting and fascinating. Some get kind of bored by it and focus on Him. Not to embrace the law, but to embrace Him. And so we see, the Lord keeps teaching the same lessons. He gives you a type, and then He gives you an antitype. And it's for the same result. And lead everybody back to Him ultimately. So I think, this is a history that's great to review. The history is interesting and fascinating. Some get kind of bored by it and find it, but it does have its sparked some applications that are messages directly to us, and that's really what we try to drive home through the minor prophets. It's not just dry reading. If you can see pictures and types that really are messages to us to be faithful, to be strong, to be hopeful.
Chris, I might have this all wrong, but I want to make sure. So when we begin Haggai, this is 521 BC after they had returned in 536, and then we had this 15-year delay. So that's where we're picking up there. Okay. I want to make sure I didn't have it. This is completely. All right, thank you very much.
And then we read the verse where 4 years later, in the sixth year of Darius, they completed the temple.
You know, we're out of time, but like at the end of Ezra, then, when you got all these different Jews who have married the foreign wives, they could have been married for a long time. Because they were there for decades. They could have been married for decades. That's really phenomenal.
Yeah, that was the thing. You didn't just run out and grab a bunch of women and say, oh, my dang, I gotta give them up. No, this was their family and their children. Tough call. Very, very strong. It's a hard choice. But that was the price of not being faithful to the truth and the Lord's desire for us to put a hard line down. And just, what does it mean to follow the Lord? There's a cost. There's a big cost.
You can see why he did it, because when the first temple was built by Solomon, it was Solomon who brought all the foreign wives in, and they brought all their idolatrous worship right into the heart of Jerusalem, so that it was only a matter of time before even the temple that Solomon had built earlier under latter kings allowed idolatrous worship right in the temple, which Ezekiel reports all about. So now that temple was destroyed, and the second temple is built, and Ezra and Nehemiah see that the priests, the very priests themselves, are bringing in these foreign wives. All they're doing mentally is going back and saying, oh no, we're duplicating what happened to the first temple. We're bringing the foreign women in, and they're going to bring in their wives and eventually weaken the hands of their husbands to stay pure, free from idolatry. And so they had to put them away. And I guess that's where Phariseeism first had its birthplace. In the best sense, the Pharisees were stringent for the law of God, and very hard and fast on it, and it was a reaction to this heathen idolatry. They didn't want it to repeat in the second temple period, but of course it decayed by the time you got to Jesus' day. The Pharisees were hypocritical in the second
temple. Okay, so as Solomon fell for the, if mama ain't happy, nobody's happy, Ezra said, then we give it to mama. Brother Steve, you have
another
announcement
this afternoon,
if the friends would be interested.
My mistake. It's got my emails mixed up somehow, and this is last week's broadcast, and I guess it's not appearing
up to this. It's a great study online.
Certainly did.
Oh, it's not a good news, it's bad news. You missed it. All right, we appreciate all the friends.